The reading is taken from the second book of Kings. When the king of Aram was at war with Israel, he would confer with his officers and he would say, "We will mobilize our forces at such and such a place." But immediately Elisha, the man of God, would warn the king of Israel, "Do not go near that place, for the Arameans have tried to practice that. Arameans are planning to mobilize their troops there." So the king of Israel would send word to the place indicated by the man of God, and time and again Elisha warned the king so that he would be on the alert there. Now the king of Aram became very upset over this, as you can imagine. He called his officers together and he demanded, "Which of you is the traitor? Who has been informing the king of Israel of my plans?" "It's not us, my lord, the king," one of the officers replied. "Elisha, the prophet in Israel, tells the king of Israel even the words you speak in private in your bedroom." "Go and find out where he is," the king commanded, "so I can send troops to seize him." And the report came back, "Elisha is in Dothan." So one night the king of Aram sent a great army with many chariots and horses to surround the city. When the servant of the man of God got up early the next morning and went outside, there were troops, horses and chariots everywhere. "Oh, sir, what will we do now?" the young man cried to Elisha. "Don't be afraid," Elisha told him, "for there are more on our side than on theirs." Then Elisha prayed, "O Lord, open his eyes and let him see." So the Lord opened the young man's eyes, and when he looked up, he saw that the hillside around Elisha was filled with horses and chariots of fire. As the Aramean army advanced towards him, Elisha prayed, "O Lord, please make them blind." So the Lord struck them with blindness, as Elisha had asked. Then Elisha went out and he told them, "You've come the wrong way. This isn't the right city. Follow me, and I will take you to the man you are looking for." And he led them to the city of Samaria. As soon as they had entered Samaria, Elisha prayed, "O Lord, now open their eyes and let them see." So the Lord opened their eyes, and they discovered that they were in the middle of Samaria. And when the king of Israel saw them, he shouted to Elisha, "My father, should I kill them? Should I kill them?" "Of course not," Elisha replied. "Do we kill prisoners of war? Give them food and drink and send them home again to their master." So the king made a great feast for them and then sent them home to their master. And after that, the Aramean raiders stayed away.
But I've got a little poem for you this morning. "I'm very ugly, so don't try to convince me that I am a very beautiful person, because at the end of the day, I hate myself in every single way, and I'm not going to lie to myself by saying there is beauty inside of me that matters. So rest assured, I will remind myself that I am a worthless, terrible person. And nothing you say will make me believe I still deserve love, because no matter what, I'm not good enough to be loved, and I'm in no position to believe that beauty does exist within me, because whenever I look in the mirror, I always think, am I as ugly as people say?" That's cheered you up, hasn't it? And just not the most cheerful of messages, is it really, when you read it like that? But I want you to do something with me, okay? don't usually do this, but I want you to read it now from the bottom line to the top. Okay? Read it with me again. Am I as ugly as people say? Because whenever I look in the mirror, I always think beauty does exist within me. And I'm in no position to believe that I'm not good enough to be loved. Because no matter what, I still deserve love. And nothing you say will make me believe that I am a worthless, terrible person. So rest assured, I will remind myself there is beauty inside of me that matters. And I'm not going to lie to myself by saying I hate myself in every single way, because at the end of the day, I am a very beautiful person. So don't try to convince me that I'm very ugly. Whee! Isn't that good? And tremendous the way the message of the poem changes completely when you read it backwards. And there's a message in that exercise, which I'm going to give this morning. And it's this. Not everything is as it seems. And I wonder if you'll do something for me today, okay? As well as having read the poem with me, for which thank you. You might find this, should you want to, is a handy way of remembering what I'm going to say. Because every now and then, I'm going to raise my hand and say, but! And I want you to join me in saying, not everything is as it seems. Can you manage that? So we heard in the poem, we can feel abandoned, unwanted, isolated, unworthy, ugly, but... You know, it's a great statement to try and get into the center of our thinking, isn't it? And it's illustrated time after time in some of the great stories of the Bible. Let's remind ourselves of one or two. Let's start in Genesis. Abraham and Sarah. Well past the age of childbearing, and yet they receive a message from God saying that they are going to have a child. And through that child, countless descendants. And I just love the note of realism and surprising touches that you get in the Bible, because you must have realized this when you've read it. Sarah basically says, you must be kidding. Am I going to have sexual pleasure? That's the gist of it. Sexual pleasure and a child in my old age? No. It was humanly impossible. But... Absolutely. And as the years went on, and do grasp that, because that is important, years, things aren't instant, years, you know, how frustrating and difficult it must have been. She even told Abraham to have sex and conceive a child with her maid, because she couldn't envisage that what she had been promised would happen. But eventually, of course, did it happen? Did it happen?
Yes.
Absolutely. God fulfilled the promise. And there is a whole nation, Israel, and possibly another, it said, the Palestinians, who owe their heritage to Abraham and Sarah. Amazing! And then later in Genesis, we get the story of Joseph, Genesis 37 to Exodus 1. You know, him of the coat of many colours. And we probably know how this story works out instantly when I've mentioned it, don't we? And you see, there's a danger in that, which is this. Some of the lessons in the story of Joseph, and indeed in many other of the biblical stories, can lose their impact because of our familiarity. And sometimes we have to stop and think, what is this story about? So as a corrective, try putting yourself in Joseph's place at the times when things weren't going well. Think of the time soon after we hear about him. He's had the dreams, which make him think that God has great plans for his future. Dreams and hopes, which he shares with his brothers, and doesn't make him particularly popular, you know. Yeah, you're all going to bow down to me. Get used to it. No? So when he is sent to find them on one occasion, they've gone off with the sheep, because as shepherds, they have to take the sheep to where they can find suitable pasture. He's sent with food, and his brothers see him coming. They strip him of his fine robe, and they throw him into a deep pit, and they sell him into slavery. And imagine Joseph's sense of betrayal, loss, perhaps even panic, wondering what was going to happen to him now. From golden boy to roughly treated slave. But then there's a chink of light in the situation, isn't there? He's purchased. Now imagine how that must have felt, you know, being bought by people. Still happens today. And he's bought by a captain of the guard of Pharaoh, a man of status and wealth. Wahey! Things are looking up! And then, remember what happens? Potiphar's wife takes a fancy to him, tries to get him into bed with her to have sex. Oh! Have you noticed how there's a lot of sex in the Bible? These two stories, there you go. And yet it's not supposed to be a polite topic, is it, for nice Christians? Well, the false testimony of the officer's wife has Joseph put in prison. Oh, no! Back there again. Not nice. He's again been betrayed. He's now in a foreign land. Imprisoned in a place that must have been rough and basic. No way out. Dreams shattered again. Things look really bad, but absolutely, Joseph gets released from prison. And not just that, he ends up as a senior member of staff in the royal courts of Egypt. Woo! One of the most powerful nations on earth at the time. And in the position he holds, guess what happens? His brothers come. And the dream he had about them bowing down to them is fulfilled, because they have to bow down to him as an officer of the Egyptian court. Don't recognize him either. What God had spoken comes to pass. And then the story goes on. His family's reunited and everything turns out rosy. It's pretty good going, isn't it? Hello? Yes. I'm after a bit of response this morning. Have you got that? You see, just to make sure that you're sort of with it and you're awake. And yeah, that's because God can bring change. God can turn things around. Circumstances change. Jump on a bit in the Bible. Another of my favourite stories is Gideon. No Gideon? Judges 6-8. And it's fascinating this, isn't it? Because it's a new phase in Israel's history as well. We've gone through from Israel being a promised nation in Genesis through to a time when they'd grown big and been enslaved and then been released, which is what Exodus is all about, and then gone on to conquer their own lands, as the many descendants that had been promised would do. That's in Joshua, the book of Joshua. And then they start to lose their grip and they lose their faithfulness to God. They get to the point of desperation. They cry out to God. God sends them a judge. Then it happens again. Goes in circles. Circle, circle, circle. And when we first read of Gideon, he's hiding in a cave, threshing wheat. You'd not be surprised to hear he's hiding in a cave because he's frightened. Cautious. Not particularly hopeful. And an angel comes to him and says, "Mighty hero! The Lord is with you." And Gideon basically says, and I love this too, you see, again, the honesty of the Bible. Gideon turns around and says, "You must be joking. Me, a mighty hero? Ah, flipping heck. Why are we in this mess? Where's the miracles we've heard about? Why has God abandoned us? Why am I in this cave fearing for my life?" And he was right. Israel was facing hard times. Gideon and his family were facing hard times. Life is, folks, isn't it? Grotty at times. And sometimes we are left for a long time in places that are hard and grotty. And this is another of those times, and it's another of those times when change seems impossible. And knowing the promises of God with a joyful spirit seems a million miles away. But Gideon accepted his commission to be a warrior and a leader. He started slowly. He sneaked out at night. I like that too. But then he went on to become one of the great rulers, the great judges of Israel. It was quite a transformation, but you see, he was. What God had said about him was absolutely what he was. He was mighty, and he was a hero, because our God can do that. And then there's the story we've heard today, 2 Kings 6, verses 8 to 23. Another great example of things not being what they seem. And the key thing in the story of Elisha and his servant is actually letting faith help us to see things in a different way. Fantastic story. Israel, you gathered from when Hazel read it, under attack. God is telling Elisha where the opposition, the king of Aram, will attack. And the king gets frustrated and finds out and decides that he'll send a load of troops to attack and get Elisha, and probably kill Elisha, or at least bring him back. And can you imagine that scene when the servant steps out of the tent in the morning, you know? Oh, Elisha, I've gone off me breakfast. Thousands of troops on the mountainside. And Elisha says, don't panic. Don't panic. It looks bad, but not everything is as it seems. And Elisha prays that his eyes will be opened. And when his eyes are opened, he looks up. And he saw that the hillside around Elisha was filled with chariots of fire and horses. The troops of the king of Aram weren't going to stand a chance. God brings about a change in perspective. And I just love the rest of that story. You know, Elisha prays for them to go blind. And, you know, he says, follow me. Now, come on, you're a soldier, okay? You might have gone blind, but would you follow somebody who was from the opposition? No. And they all dutifully plod away and end up before the king of Israel. What a daft load. But there you go. That's another aspect of the story. One final Old Testament example. I'll move on. And I include it because it's another example of the change in circumstances, a change in perspective and attitude that makes a difference rather than a change of circumstances. And it's important because that is the case. And it comes from Psalm 73. And it reflects one of those times, sure, we've all faced them, when life bites and kicks us because money is tight. Or desperately short. And because of that, we're limited in what we can do or buy because we lack the bank balance for it. And in those times, you know, one of the inevitable facts of life is we always compare ourselves with those who have more, don't we? Rather than those who have less. Because it feels unjust. We feel the frustration of the lack of choice that we have. We're boxed in. And so easily we reach the point of thinking that everybody is having a better time than us. And also that those who are better off than us are proud, mean, unthinking, unjust, and laughing at our despair in their comfort. That is what the psalmist is feeling in Psalm 73, and if you've never read it, you should. Lacking in hope. But through worship, his thinking is changed. His perspective is altered. I'll underline that, through worship. What are we doing here this morning? Worshipping. See, it's important being with the people of God. Church, God's idea, important. And there's one of the reasons. So often, being together brings about a change in our thinking and our perspective. Back to the psalm and the psalmist. He's reminded himself that wealth can lead to missing out on relationship with God. Envy can make our own hearts bitter and torn. The gifts of peace and joy, even trust and friendship, can be missed by those who put wealth first. Even health can be affected. And even where it isn't, the certainty of a glorious destiny can be lost to those who solely focus on wealth. Things aren't always what they seem. So how is life looking for you today? Let's make an application of this. How is life looking for you today? Are you at peace? Are you in a good place? Or is life difficult? Is it hard to believe that change can come? And if you're in that place, do you think the preacher, and I mean me, is being too simplistic and that Bible stories are one thing, the realities of life another? Please let me stress something. I am not here today to downgrade anybody's life's circumstances, particularly if they're grotty, or tell anybody in this room that if you are in a bad place, all you need to do is trust in God and things will quickly change. No. Because the Bible is more realistic than that, and our faith should be more realistic than that. Life can be challenging, unfair, and unjust. And faith is not a magic pill that helps heal all our woes. Or is it a ladder by which we climb out from every pit that we feel we are in? I acknowledge that the danger of a message like this is to give that impression, but no. The Bible tells us of people being overwhelmed and discouraged by life's circumstances. Even to the point of actually telling us of a situation when in despair and hopelessness, a king falls on his own sword, and a disciple of Jesus takes his own life. And honesty demands that I state clearly that life's events can leave us in a grotty place for a long time. And the bad times can be overwhelming. And yet, actually, none of that does take away from the basic point of the message this morning. And rather than now saying, but, I'll say, because not everything is as it seems. God can bring change. The timing can be frustrating and a mystery that we need to acknowledge honestly. We're in God's hands. But thankfully, change does come, will come. We know that because of the stories we have and because of experience. And hey, we haven't mentioned the main events of Christianity yet, have we? The cross and resurrection. And imagine what it would have been like to have been there on that Good Friday, probably have done before or tried. Hope crushed, gone. The deliverer. The Saviour, the hope of Israel, crucified, defeated, killed. Did that look hopeless? You bet. But then on the third day, an empty tomb. The announcement, he is not here, he is risen. Then the gift of the Holy Spirit and the promise that the Lord of the whole universe is through Jesus and by the Holy Spirit with us always. With us always. Whatever our circumstances, whatever our situations. And our response to the situations of life, particularly the hard times, can and should be one of faith and trust. And that faith and trust should be there for us, not on the basis that we're going to get out of this tricky situation, but because God is worthy of our faith and our trust, and has shown that countless times. Faith can change our perspective on things, as it did for Elisha and the psalmist. Faith can give us the hope that things will change, as it did for the other characters in the Bible stories we've mentioned today. The timing is God's, the outcome of faith is God's gift to us and not for us to force. It is for us to remember that not everything is as it seems. God is always present, always at work, even when we don't see it or feel it. God is wonderful. Do you know, in fact, God is beautiful, and so are you.